later than expected. Russian news agencies are reporting that this is the first time in a dozen years that Soyuz flights to the space station have failed to undock. The crew was reported to be in good condition. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Gallagher in Moscow.
Aircraft and autos aren't selling like they used to, underscoring the latest drop in orders to U.S. factories. Commerce Department analysts found that demand for big-ticket items fell 1.3% last month. But take aircraft out of the mix, and orders actually appeared to rise in August by 2%. That reflects strong gains in demand for primary metals. And we're seeing strong gains on Wall Street. Dow's up 175 points at 10,838. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Plowshares Fund, dedicated to helping build a safe, secure, and nuclear weapon-free world at plowshares.org.
One in six children in eastern Illinois might not have enough to eat. What does childhood hunger look like here, and what's being done about it? Join us for the 4th Annual Hunger Symposium, Monday, September 27th at 6:30 p.m. at Illinois Terminal, downtown Champaign. For more information, visit will.illinois.edu or call 217-333-7300. This Hunger Symposium is brought to you by Eastern Illinois Food Bank and Illinois Public Media.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning classical music critic Tim Page talks about his memoir, Parallel Play, which describes how his diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome changed his life. And Nick Hornby, the author of High Fidelity, talks about his latest novel, Juliet Naked. Both books are now out in paperback. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls. In 1879, Mark Twain was in Europe. He'd found a lot in continental culture to mock, but the thing that made him the most unhappy was the food. And when he was there, he thought about all of the things that he wanted but couldn't get, the things that as soon as he got off the boat, when he got back to America, the things that he really wanted to have. And he came up with a list of 80 American foods, many of them regional specialties. Our guest for this author, writer Andrew Beers, wondered just how many of these foods still appeared on American tables, and he set out on a quest for 8 of them, and this is a story that he writes about in a recent book that we'll be talking about here this morning. The title of his book is Twain's Feast, subtitle Searching for America's Lost Foods in the Footsteps of Samuel Clemens. The book is published by the Penguin Press, and it's just recently out. A little bit more about our guest, Andrew Beers. He's the author of 2 novels. Also, his work has appeared in the New York Times, Gastronomica, the Virginia Quarterly Review, the Writer's Chronicle, Ocean Magazine, Food History News, and Living Bird. Mr. Beers, hello.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. I must say that when I first picked up the book, I was intrigued, first because it involved Mark Twain, and perhaps second because it involved food history, and I thought that was pretty interesting. But then when I opened up the book and realized that one of the things that Twain really wanted and the first object on your search was Illinois prairie hen, I said, okay, we have to do this. We absolutely have to do this. And so I'm really pleased that you could spend some time with us. Let's just talk about Twain when he was in Europe. This was 1879, and he was traveling there, and eventually this would end up as his book, Tramp Abroad. Right?
Yeah, that's right. He'd been traveling around the continent for over a year, and during that time was limited to eating in European hotels for the most part. And so though he loved eating in European private homes when he had the opportunity, that came up very, very seldom. And he found the food in hotels to be insipid, used the word decayed, tasteless. At best, he found it tolerable. And that's what prompted his writing this long fantasy menu of favorite American foods.
Yeah, there's one point here where he apparently in the book talks about trying to learn some German. And you have here some of the German phrases he thought it would be important to be able to know and to speak. And they include, this tea isn't good. This coffee isn't good. This bread seems old. is there a curious smell about fill in the blank? And isn't that something in the butter? So that was a little bit of a commentary on the quality of the food that he found. And again, we're talking here about institutional hotel food, so it wouldn't quite be the same as if you actually had the opportunity to have some real European home cooking.
No, I'm sure that's true, but you know, whatever the reason, his frustration had definitely been building for quite some time by the time he sat down and started writing down his favorite American food.
Yeah. And we won't read all the way through the list, but when you go down, you see some things clearly that are things we could have today if you know where to go, and some things that now maybe are a little harder to come by. Maybe there are some things that you actually couldn't have at all now. What are just a few of the things that maybe in your mind stand out from his list that he really wanted to have?
Well, you know, it ranged all over. He had fresh produce on it. He actually started with radishes and baked apples with cream, included green corn cut from the ear and served with butter and pepper, new rose potatoes roasted in the ashes, so a lot of fresh garden produce, lettuce, asparagus. There were also carefully prepared baked goods and breads, many of which he wanted Southern style. He was a great partisan of Southern style cooking throughout his life, and said that certain dishes like fried chicken and cornbread could only be prepared in the South, and trying to do it outside the region would always end up with a counterfeit product. But the things that really jumped off the menu to me were the wild things, because those were the things that he got most specific about, most exact. So he wouldn't just say that he wanted trout or even lake trout. It was lake trout from Tahoe or terrapin from Philadelphia, sheep's head and croakers, which are both very humble fish, from New Orleans, and, of course, prairie hens from Illinois.
Yeah. What's really interesting here is if you look at this list and then think about what a lot of people today are looking for in their food. Nowadays, people, certainly, they want good, fresh, local ingredients. They'd like to know who it is that produced that thing that they ate. And that's really at the heart of what Twain is talking about here as well. And you note the fact that as he's writing about these things, he so often uses words like genuine and real, and certainly to him, the idea of something that was fresh was also really important.
I think it's very striking how relevant his menu is how relevant it is today. It's working on this, it really struck me that words like fresh, genuine, real, even local, they're definitely not just modern catchphrases. They've been the basis for the best of American cooking for a very long time. And when Twain wrote this list, often he would just, he'd list just produce, sweet potatoes, butter beans, and you gather from what he said about European produce and what he ate in the hotels that he was very dedicated to the notion that these things should have come to the table as quickly as possible from nearby. I mean, he talked about feeling sweet to all the world while traveling through the Alps when he had the opportunity to buy berries and fresh milk from children by the side of the road. So though he hated European hotel cream because he felt that it had been watered down and was sometimes old, when he had the chance to drink fresh milk, he was extremely happy.
Yeah. So just I will run down the list of the eight things that you picked off his list, and we can talk about some of these things. It starts with prairie hens, and he was very specific that he wanted them from Illinois. Also, possum and raccoon, trout at Lake Tahoe, oysters and mussels in San Francisco, Philadelphia terrapin, which is a turtle soup, sheephead and croakers from New Orleans, and those are both fish that I'd never heard of. Maybe you wouldn't have if you hadn't been there or grown up there, cranberries, and then he finishes up with maple syrup. So as you say, what's interesting is that these are all very distinctly regional, and they are really all wild. They're really all wild foods.
Yes, they're all wild, and they're all things that he would have experienced during his travels from coast to coast. Lake Tahoe trout, for example, that wasn't something that you could have eaten very far from Lake Tahoe. You actually had to go there. And, you know, he was there in October of 1861, maybe once or twice in the year after, just very, very briefly. But that's when he ate Lake Tahoe trout. In later years, there was a commercial fishery out of the lake. But when Twain experienced these things, they were very rooted. They were the definition of local foods. You had to go to New Orleans to eat sheep's head from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. So when he thought about these things, I think he was also remembering his travels across the country and the places that they came from. And that was one of the things that became very exciting to me in writing Twain's Feast, was the opportunity to see what's happened to these places and these things.
Well, and certainly over the course of his life, there was a change in the way that Americans ate as we moved toward more of a food industry like we have today, people with large producers shipping foods, maybe some long distances, so that the American diet started to become a little bit more standardized, sort of in the sense that there were more people and more places that were kind of eating the same stuff.
Definitely. And you can see that happening even in the cases of the wild foods in his lifetime. When he was a boy, I think that a lot of his standards for what fresh, good food were, I think that a lot of his standards were set very early on, both in Hannibal, Missouri, and in his uncle's prairie farm, his uncle John Quarles' prairie farm, where he knew a lot of fresh produce, game that was being taken out of the woods and the forest and all that kind of thing. And one of the things he ate then was prairie hens, and I believe always associated prairie hens with his youth for that reason. But in later years, prairie hens were being shipped all over the country, and he actually had a friend that would send him two prairie chickens to his home in Hartford every year. In fact, he received a brace for Christmas in 1879. So very briefly after writing this, very shortly after writing this menu, he actually did taste prairie chickens, but this time in Connecticut.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Andrew Beers, and his book is Twain's Feast, Searching for America's Lost Foods in the Footsteps of Sam Clemens. And again, as we explained, this sort of grows out of some writing that Clemens did when he was traveling in Europe in 1879, and he was spending a lot of time in hotels and eating hotel food, and he was pretty unhappy about it. So he started thinking about all of the great American foods that he knew and he loved, and put together this long list of things that he thought, as soon as he got back, if he could, he would like to have all of these things. And our guest said, well, he was pretty interested in that idea and picked a few to see if, in fact, he could still find these, and wrote about it in this book. And it's really interesting reading if you're interested in sort of American cultural history, particularly when it comes to food, or you're interested in Mr. Clemens and his life. I would suggest you go out and look for the book, and it's published by the Penguin Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe I should just ask you to talk a little bit more about how it is you even embarked on this project, and what was it that that got you interested in going on this long trek looking for some of these things that, at least to me, seem fairly exotic.
Well, I was fascinated by the menu from the start, its range and its depth, and the obvious passion that Twain had for these foods. But the thing that really made the book start to take shape was when I started looking at prairie chickens, prairie hens from Illinois. I thought, like, well, I'll look into all of these foods and find out how they would have been prepared historically and have a good time cooking that. And maybe I'll put something together like a cookbook, a compilation of historical recipes with a few comments on what the foods were like back then. But when I started looking at prairie hens from Illinois, I realized there was more of a story behind some of these foods than I had expected going in. So, you know, prairie hens, I had never heard of prairie hens or prairie chickens before. You know, they're this large grouse that live in the tall grass prairie. And it turns out that there's this long story about their place in American food, where in Twain's youth, there were about 14 million of the birds in Illinois. That was the peak of the population. Today, there's about 300 in Prairie Ridge State Natural Area in the southern part of the state, in Newton. And so I went back and, you know, visited Newton and saw the prairie chickens booming on their mating grounds in the early spring, which was this really astonishing experience for me. There are these, the male prairie chickens give off this haunting, lilting cry that can be heard across miles of either cornfields or prairies. And the thought that there were 14 million of these birds as opposed to 300, I think they would have been an absolutely integral part of the tall grass prairie in Twain's youth. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that, in fact, there were more prairie chickens when Twain was living in Missouri, right across the river from Illinois, of course. There were more prairie chickens at that moment than ever before and ever since. The reason being that the prairie was starting to be plowed up after the invention of the John Deere self-scouring steel plow in 1837. And so there was this amazing checkerboard of corn and tall grass for several decades, and it was an absolutely perfect habitat for the prairie chickens. They had food from the corn that was coming in, and they still had enough habitat for nesting in the tall grass. And so for a while, they became a presence on tables, not only in Illinois, not only in Missouri, but all around the country. This was after Twain left and went west, so this was a little bit later in his life. But prairie chickens were being served on the tables of Delmonico's in New York, which was considered the best recipe in the best restaurant in the country at the time. These very elaborate preparations with truffles and coxcombs and kind of put into these very elaborate molds. So they were known nationally as a food. These prairie chickens that were being hunted by the hundreds of thousands and being shipped up through Chicago and out. But the reason that the prairie chickens eventually more or less disappeared, there's still some in Minnesota, many fewer than that in Illinois, wasn't so much the hunting, it was the conversion of their habitat. It was the fact that there was more and more agriculture coming in, and they needed an amount of grass to be able to nest in and hide in. And once we reached a kind of tipping point where there was far more agriculture than tall grass prairie in the area, then prairie chickens really started to disappear. And so to me, this was just a really striking story about not only prairie chickens, but kind of the transformation of the American landscape. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I wanted to go much deeper into the story of many of these foods.
And that's, I think, the thing that holds all these essays together, and that is the connection between the food and the natural environment, and then also people. That's what it is that brings all these things together and looks at how the environment has changed, how people live and the way that has changed, and then how what people think about what's good to eat has also changed. All those things change together.
Absolutely. You see it in food after food. I mean, in the case of the prairie chickens, it's the transformation of the prairie. In the case of the Lahontan cutthroat trout that I mentioned before, you know, those were absolutely amazing fish when Twain was at Lake Tahoe. It was a very specific moment that he ate them. And when he was there, trout in the lake could have grown to as big as 30 pounds. It was a very different fish than we're used to seeing now. There's just nothing like that anymore. In fact, there's rumors of even 40 and 50-pound trout from a nearby lake. Eventually, damming up some of the rivers and spawning runs meant that specific variety of Lahontan cutthroat trout disappeared from the area. Or terrapin from Philadelphia, that's very tied into the use of eastern wetlands and the way some of that has been built up. But I did want to stress and explore the human component to each of these foods, because I am interested in the way that they've fit into people's lives. I mean, I started with what did these foods mean to Twain? How did he experience them? How did he experience the places they came from? And so, as you said, I want to see what their place is in people's lives today as well, even with the foods that haven't that we still have. There's really no shortage of raccoons in the United States anymore. In fact, there's probably far, far more than there were back then. So raccoons absolutely thrive in suburban development. I think it's 20 to 30 times as many raccoons can live in the suburbs as would in the woods. They just do very, very well. So we've moved away from raccoon not because they're scarce, but just as a kind of a national culinary decision. But that said, raccoon is very important in Gillette, Arkansas, where I went and visited during the writing of the book. They still have a raccoon supper once a year in early January where they serve the meat to 1,000 people in the local high school auditorium. And this is in a town of about 800 people total. So there's actually there's a lot of out-of-towners that come in for this event. And it's very important for them as kind of a pivot point of the year. It's a very distinct part of the town. A lot of the year is spent building up for it. They have to get the raccoon. The local farmer and businessmen's association starts gathering for a week in advance to cook it and prepare it. So even the foods that we still have, they can still be very important socially and really help to mark out people's lives, I think, in something like the way that Twain would have experienced
them. Yeah.
Well.
Before we get too far away from the prairie chicken, I feel like I really should mention it here just in case people are uncertain that, first of all, that in the state of Illinois, this is a protected bird. It is not legal to hurt them. So what you did when you came to Illinois, you just went to see them. You didn't eat one.
No, definitely not. Yeah, it's legal. There are a couple of states where it is legal. In Minnesota, you can enter a lottery. But I was very clear going into this book, because I knew that these foods were rare, that it wasn't going to be my mission in life to taste each and every one of them. Illinois prairie chickens were definitely one that I considered very much off limits. There's only about 300 birds, and they're startling animals. They're really wonderful.
Well, having said that, though, I must ask you, what does raccoon taste like?
You know, they really cook it for a long time before it gets to the plate. When I arrived, they were nice enough to let me help a bit and to tag along during the cooking. So I got there on Thursday morning at dawn. They'd already been brining the meat overnight, so it had been in kind of a salt and sugar solution. Then they boil it with onions and celery and black pepper, and then they strip off all the fat, which, you know, as you know, carries a lot of flavor, and so that removes maybe some of what would have made it distinct. And then they keep it overnight, and the next day smoke it and pour barbecue sauce over it. So by the time you actually get to the raccoon, it's a little bit tough to really get at the flavor. But I would describe it as kind of a gamey pot roast. It has some of that kind of dark, that dark texture, but you can definitely tell that you're not eating beef.
This, I don't know how many people have the opportunity anymore to have wild game. I think probably not. Many. I've had venison, but it was farm-raised. And I'm sure that, you know, you could tell the difference between chicken, pork, and beef, I suppose. But that again, something that a meat that is really distinct and strongly flavored on its own is just not something I think we experience much anymore. And unless you hunt or you know somebody who does, that's not an experience that is going to be easy to have.
No, that's definitely true. When I was down in Arkansas, I had the opportunity to taste mallard duck that was broiled with bacon and jalapeno. It was absolutely fantastic. And it struck me that today we can still distinguish between wild fish fairly easily. A lot of diners can. So you go in and you sit down, you know the difference between ordering tuna, swordfish, salmon. These are very distinct flavors on the plate. A 100 years ago, that would have been true for many people for wild game as well. There was a distinction between canvasback ducks and mallard ducks. Canvasbacks were really the more favored one. That's what you see a lot in Victorian America, is people praising the canvasback ducks as one of the most distinct dishes in America, especially along the East Coast and through the Chesapeake. So it's true. Much of our wild game has vanished, at least from commercial restaurant tables. You either have to get it yourself or know somebody. But I do think that it also raises the question of how we're going to handle our fisheries going forward. You know, when these are obviously foods that Twain valued in his lifetime, and some of them simply aren't available anymore. So it's very easy to see how if you don't take care of these things, they can disappear, including the ones that mean a lot to you.
Yeah. And can you still get sheep's head and croakers?
Yeah, actually, those are very easy. Croaker are an open water fish. They still are very plentiful in the Gulf. In fact, they're sometimes used as bait. They really are something that come up almost as a bycatch, and people put in the work on preparing them if they know how to do it. But croaker are bony enough that they're often just fried whole. And people eat the tail as kind of a crunchy little treat. But there's a lot of croaker, and you can still get sheep's head. They tend to be more brackish. The ones I had in New Orleans were caught in the Lake Pontchartrain, and they're fantastic. They're known as poor man's crab meat because they have that kind of flaky texture and even the taste of jumbo lump crab because they they feed on crab. The name actually comes from their distinctive jaw and teeth, which they use to crunch up crab shell. And so from eating all these crab, they take on that flavor themselves. They're a wonderful fish, and they're very economical. I fear that we're seeing a moment where even they might vanish off the tables, at least for a time, with the oil spill down there.
Yeah.
I just read the other day that some of the tarballs are starting to get into Lake Pontchartrain right now, which is where these fish came from. And so, I fear that this is a moment that we can watch one of these fish disappear, at least for a time.
And this, again, going back to Twain, this was something that really connected to his youth, because this would have been one of those things that he had when he was on the river.
That's right. He was a riverboat pilot for years until the Civil War put an end to it. He had to flee the river, or else he was going to be drafted by either the Confederacy or the Union, who were in desperate need of steamboat pilots. But some of the happiest times of his life were spent piloting down from Cairo, Illinois, down to New Orleans, which was as far down as the riverboats would ever go. And so he'd have a day, a night, maybe a couple of days in New Orleans to explore. And that's when you read about him enjoying sheep's head down there. They were a relatively inexpensive fish a lot of the time. Croakers certainly were. But both of them also could have been cooked in more of an elevated way. He wrote his brother once about enjoying sheep's head cooked with shrimps and oysters in what he called a French restaurant. I suspect he was probably talking about a Creole restaurant. I'm not sure he would have made that distinction at the time. But he loved them, and I think associated them with some of those happy times when he was going up and down the river.
I'm struck here by something that you write early on in the book, where you write, "I've always hated it when people say America doesn't have a real cuisine, as though fast food were the only thing we can truly call our own." And what's, I think, striking about the book and the things that you write about is that there are many things that are distinctly American, but it also strikes me that maybe the key is not so much the preparation, because it's not always very elaborate. It may be very particular, but not elaborate. The thing that's the key here is the ingredient.
I think that's true. The preparation can obviously be important, but if for Twain, and I think this holds true today, if you have it's grown locally, that's grown as close as possible to the source, a tree that does particularly well in a region, then that becomes a very American thing, no matter what the origin of it is, even what kind of recipe you're using it in. He loved fresh fruit. He loved fresh vegetables. I mean, these are the things that I think can still form the basis for the best American cooking today.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Andrew Beers. And by the way, if you go looking for his book, his last name is spelled B-E-A-H-R-S. And the book is Twain's Feast, Searching for America's Lost Foods in the Footsteps of Samuel Clemens. It's published by the Penguin Press. And his jumping off point here was something that Twain, Mr. Clemens, wrote when he was traveling in Europe in 1879 and had spent a lot of time in hotels eating hotel food, bad hotel food. And at one point he started thinking about all the great things that he missed about America. And there was this long list of things, of foods, that he thought, as soon as I get back, these are the things that I want to have. And they were very specific. They were very particular. A lot of them, as we explained, were wild. Wild-caught things, and they were very particular to particular regions. So Andrew said, well, he was interested in thinking about this and talking about the connections between the place people live and what they ate and how eating in America has changed. And so he picked eight of these things, and we've talked about a couple of them. The first section is on Illinois prairie hen, and Mr. Twain was very specific about how he wanted prairie hen from Illinois. And there are a number of other things in the book, and it's quite pleasant to read. So you might want to take a look at it, Twain's Feast. And we have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with somebody in Champaign to start us off. Line one. Hello.
Hey, just to remind you that the gentleman may not have been looking at prairie chickens that are Illinois gene pool, because the gene pool got so low that they had to go to other states like Missouri to augment that gene pool that's at Newton. So that It's just a reminder that we can eliminate a species. Comment on the fat. One of the reasons why we're living longer is that we no longer do things like eat pure lard on bread for breakfast. So, yes, these recipes will be full of the flavor that comes with fat, but we can no longer afford to do that. We've learned that low fat, and also the preservative used is sugar or salt, and that reduces the lifespan also, and a large percentage of carbohydrate. I'm waiting to hear a recipe for passenger pigeons. So, thanks for your commentary. Very interesting.
Sure. Well, and I obviously the caller makes a good point that that the way people ate at this point, and maybe you'd have to say, you know, wealthy people. Not everybody could eat this way, but maybe even poor people. You know, maybe what, by today's understanding of what makes for a healthy diet, maybe we wouldn't want to eat this way. So we certainly don't cook the way today. We don't cook the way we cooked 100 years ago.
Well, that's definitely right. I think that in terms of the fat content, I think that it's, you know, it's really the kind of fake oils that we use in large part now with, hydrogenated oils are the things that I think are really probably most problematic from a modern dietary stance. I think that a lot of these things still can be eaten, absolutely, especially in moderation. And like so much of it just comes down to fresh produce that's carefully prepared. I think you'd actually do pretty well off this from a dietary perspective, although, of course, you'd have to decide which things to emphasize. You'd probably be you'd end up eating a lot more garden fresh asparagus than you would deep fried croaker fish.
Yeah. And we should again make the point, and we did talk a little bit about this, that because we here have been talking about some meat items, but that Twain did on his list, he wanted fresh fruit and he wanted fresh vegetables, and he does have a lot of vegetables on his list, and he wanted good bread, so it was not. It's a pretty well, when you look at the entire list, all 80 things that he has here, it's really pretty well-rounded.
Yeah, the wild foods I focused on in the book because they really tell the story of how American food changed, I think, most vividly. But, of course, as the wild foods went out, sometimes it was because domestic foods were coming in and getting more, receiving more emphasis. And so they are very much a presence both on the menu and in the book, even though I think that telling the story of the wild foods was my way of telling the larger tale. To go to his point about the gene pool of the prairie chickens, that's it. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. They've had to bring in more birds from Missouri and Minnesota to kind of augment the gene pool in southern Illinois, because you need a certain minimum number of birds, or else eventually they start getting too inbred and the eggs don't last and that kind of thing. So when Twain wrote, it was Illinois prairie chickens because they would have been both the most abundant and probably the fattest birds. They were doing so well off of the corn. Mm-hmm. That's not true anymore. And in fact, the main reason that that any prairie chickens lasted in southern Illinois is because people were growing red top grass there up through World War II. It's a grass that's used for dye. And then when synthetic dyes came in after the war, even that was turned over to corn, and so the prairie chickens couldn't even live on cultivated grasses. And that's where we really saw it kind of go through the floor, and they had to start bringing in more birds from elsewhere.
All right. Let's talk with some other folks. We have a couple people here in Urbana. We'll go first to line number 2 in Urbana. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I had a question about home cooking, specifically in Hannibal. There's very little in Twain's autobiographical writings about Jane Lambton Clemens and what she put on the dining table in that house. The author mentioned the great feast at the Quarles Farm, which was outside of town, and Twain describes that almost as a holiday from what he was normally getting. I was wondering, was Jane Clemens a lousy cook, or were things harder in the village than they were out in the countryside? How do we account for that? It's like a sizable hole in his reminiscences.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and it's something that I think I almost had to extrapolate. I don't really know how Jean Clemens was as a how she was as a cook. I think that if you read between the lines in books like Tom Sawyer, which was at least partially thinly veiled autobiography, I think that Twain as a boy really enjoyed food that he could use almost as a part of his boyish freedom or even a rebellion. And he talks an awful lot about hooking sugar off the table when nobody's looking or when the boys are out on the island, the experience of frying fish there and the joy of frying fish by themselves out on the river. It often comes up as one of Huck Finn's kind of character traits, is that he's cooking his own corn pone. He's making what he calls a barrel of odds and ends, where the juices all swap together and things go well together. So I think that he food at home was something that he used is something that he enjoyed as an element of freedom, when he could kind of get away and prepare his own small thing. It was really at the Quarles Farm that he seems to have buckled down and really loved the food that was being put on the table.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right, thank you. On to someone else in Urbana. This is line 3. Hello.
Yes, I'm just curious about the fish sheep's head. Is that the same one that is fish of the same name that's caught in the upper Mississippi and its tributaries?
The upper Mississippi? I don't believe so. I mean, I think it needs a degree of brackish water. So I don't think you find it much above the wetlands and kind of brackish lakes around New Orleans.
Okay, so it's simply two fish with the same name.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of wiggle room in the names of fish. It was actually croaker is one thing that I spent a little time on, because croakers, sometimes people call redfish croakers, and that would have changed the tenor of that chapter a lot if it had turned out that Twain's croakers were the same things that were later prepared by, Paul Prudhomme as black and redfish, and they really have a central role in the history of New Orleans cooking. It turned out they were much more of a humble fish, but you see names of fish changing and kind of blending together a lot. One of the great examples is that orange roughy was known as slimehead about 20 years ago, and Chilean sea bass used to be known as Patagonian toothfish. So you're actually even legally allowed to define these fish however you want for commercial reasons, or at least in very broad strokes. And so I think that sheep's head probably, I believe it's a different fish. There's also a California sheep's head that we have out here that's very different. It's more of a deep water ocean fish.
Yes, when it comes to changing names of food, that's a fairly common strategy. You realize that what we call canola oil today used to be called rapeseed oil.
Oh, is that right?
Which wasn't
marketable.
Yes, well, it comes from a member of the cabbage family called rape.
That makes sense. It's like Twain actually overheard two men when he was traveling down the Mississippi somewhat later in life in the 1880s. One of them was talking about how he was going to be developing a synthetic butter and slipping it onto American tables and nobody would ever notice. And the other one was talking about using a vegetable oil that he was going to insert some kind of flavor agent and sell it as imported olive oil. And he was somewhat appalled overhearing this conversation, but they were swapping business cards and slapping each other on the back. And it's not an unusual thing to have happen, of course.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go over to Belgium for another caller here. Line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. You mentioned that Twain didn't join the military during the Civil War, but in fact, didn't he join a Confederate unit in Missouri? Didn't like it a lot, and immediately struck out for Nevada.
Yeah, it's an interesting episode. He joined a group of Confederate irregulars. The main account he wrote of that was a personal history of a campaign that failed. He wrote it many, many years later, and in perfect Twain fashion, it's both very funny and deeply sad. He describes how they fired at night on somebody that they sure was an enemy picket, and it turned out to be just a farmer returning home, and this man died. It's not totally clear whether that's an exaggerated account of what happened, but what we do know is that he didn't serve for long. He kind of got swept up in the local war movement and joined the Confederate Army for a very brief period, I think less than a month.
Yeah.
And then his brother Orion was appointed assistant secretary in the Washoe Territory, what's today Nevada. And so he had the opportunity to go with him, and he jumped on it in a heartbeat. If he'd been very enthusiastic about the war effort one way or the other, I think he would have been a riverboat pilot. These were among the most valuable recruits. If you ever read Twain's account in Life of the Mississippi of what was involved in the apprenticeship of a river pilot, it's astonishing the amount of information that they had to master in order to be able to pilot these riverboats. Any army without riverboat pilots was going to be absolutely stuck.
I also find it interesting in this aspect that in the end of his life, he dealt with Grant and his biography and had a very high regard for him. Seems like he changed his tone as he got older.
I don't know that he was ever an enthusiastic Confederate supporter. He was in the Army for a brief period, but then by the time he got west into the Washoe Territory, he talks in Roughing It about how one of the great disappointments of his life is that one day he and some other people in the Nevada silver mining town where he was for that period looked up, and on the mountaintop somebody had put an American flag, and there was a single beam of light that illuminated the American flag. And people came out and looked at it. It was this gorgeous sight. And he was deeply disappointed when he later found out that that was the day that that the Union had defeated Lee at Gettysburg and that Vicksburg had fallen. And the telegraph operator actually knew this, but had to sit on the news for 24 hours for contractual reasons. And Twain just said, "My God, the party we could have had if we'd known that we'd seen this flag flying at the time of such a victory." And so, at least later, he was very much a supporter of the Union cause, and even early in life, I think was fairly ambivalent on the question.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I think it's also true that Twain was quite well traveled and had lived in the West, in the South, and in the Northeast, and seemed to find some way to identify with all of those places.
He just had an amazing life in that way. He really did know different parts of the United States in a time of immense change in America. I mean, he really knew the Mississippi was probably the land or waterscape that he knew best. But certainly the happiest years of his life were later thought to be in Hartford, where he settled down with his family. Of course, his boyhood sensibility and some of his fondest memories were always of Missouri and Illinois, where he was born and raised. And he spent so much of his life looking back at that moment. It really inspired much of his best writing. But he emerged as a writer in Washoe, Nevada, and San Francisco, and in the silver and gold mining territories there. But also at the time, he was probably best known as, in his lifetime, he may have been best known as a travel writer. Now we think of him as a novelist first and foremost, mm-hmm. Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer. But his best-selling book was The Innocents Abroad, and people loved Roughing It. That was a really important profession at the time because he was helping Americans to understand their country and how they fit into it. And that, I think, is what was one of the things that really excited me about his menu, is that you can look at it and track his travels through the menu. I mean, he's born in Illinois. He goes to Philadelphia as a printer's apprentice and eats terrapin soup there. He becomes a steamboat pilot on the Mississippi and enjoys sheep's head and croakers. Later, he flees west to Tahoe and to San Francisco, where he eats trout and mussels and oysters and on and on. It really tracks his life right up through 1879 when he wrote it.
Our guest is Andrew Beers, and we're talking about what you'll find in his book, Twain's Feast, Searching for America's Lost Foods in the Footsteps of Samuel Clemens, published by the Penguin Press, just recently out. We'll be here for about another 6-7 minutes. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. There, some things on this list are sort of exotic and maybe wouldn't be things that people would experience. Probably not that many people are going to be eating raccoon. There are some things here that are, if you know where to go, you can get good fried chicken Southern style, and you can get biscuits, and you can get soft shell crabs and a lot of other things. I'm interested, just as we're coming down to the end, there are two things that you conclude with that maybe almost everybody has had, and are associated with holidays, and maybe just associated with kicking back and weekend and breakfast. And the two things I'm thinking of are cranberries and maple syrup. What was it that made you pick those two things and finish up with those?
Well, you know, it's interesting. They're both such domestic foods now. Cranberries are so closely associated with holidays, especially Thanksgiving and Christmas, I think. And maple syrup is something I think most people think about enjoying on breakfast tables in the morning. Mm-hmm. It's a very homey food. But it was striking looking at these, how closely related or how recently they've been wild. Maple syrup, I think, still is really a wild food in many ways. It comes out of wild trees. You know, these maple trees take up to 40 years before they can really start producing and being tapped. And so most maple syrup is produced from wild groves. People tend them and, cut out other trees in order to promote them and that kind of thing. But they're not formal plantations, kind of row by row of trees. It's the man that I was able to spend some time with, Bill Pruill in Connecticut, he's a retired police officer and from Hartford, and he and his wife tap 3,000 trees, but they're mostly in their neighbor's backyards and on their neighbor's kind of vacant lots. He just gets permission and goes around with his truck and collects the sap for a couple months early in the spring. And so, I mean, he really does this for the love of it. It's his way of experiencing the landscape in a different way than he would ordinarily be able to. And cranberries, now they're cultivated, but they were cultivated for the first time, I think, in 1817 by Henry Hall in Cape Cod. Before that time, cranberries would come to the market in Massachusetts, Connecticut, what have you, as a foraged food. Children would go out and gather cranberries, and they'd bring them to the city markets. It wasn't until 1817, which is really just yesterday in terms of agricultural history, that somebody figured out that if you put sand over the vines and weeded out some of the competition, it would promote stronger growth. And the cranberries that we eat are still largely the same varieties that people were eating in the 1840s. These are vines that were seen to be particularly productive in the wild bogs of Massachusetts and New Jersey and were taken out and just promoted. Now there are some hybrid varieties, but early blacks and Howes are still among the most important commercial cranberry cultivars. And so that's amazing to me. I mean, it's so frequent that you look at a crop and it's like apples have been cultivated for thousands of years and the original one doesn't look anything like a modern apple would. But cranberries, you go out and get a wild cranberry, it's a cranberry. You recognize it right away. I saw the wild bogs that are maintained by the Wampanoag tribe on Martha's Vineyard. And for them, the cranberry harvest is a very important part of the year. Cranberry Day, all the Wampanoag children get the day off from school, and people gather in the bog and pick these cranberries. And so they maintain it with an eye, as a wild bog, but with an eye to promoting the cranberry production every year. And I didn't see any distinction between the cranberries there and the ones that I saw in bogs, more formal bogs in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Mm.
We're coming down to a couple of minutes left. I guess I find myself thinking about, Twain and his menu in this discussion and what this says about what life should be about, I guess. And certainly he was a man who was very fortunate in having the kind of experiences that he had. And, sometimes in talking about Twain, we focus on this idea that he has this kind of dark side, and certainly he had loss and disappointment in his life, particularly in his later adult life. And at the same time, thinking about it this way, I guess, does make you think about what, as you write here in the book, what makes life worth living? And you write, for Twain, life without variety, life without change was literally not worth living. Do you come away with some, did that inspire you to think about life a little bit differently?
It definitely did. I don't think you can read about read Twain and not feel that way. He was somebody who felt joy very deeply, but as a result, he also felt loss very deeply. He was a passionate person, and seeing the pleasure that he took in these foods that he knew so deeply was inspiring to me, to kind of look at the things in my life that I appreciate, that I want to see last. And for that reason, it was also very inspiring, and I thought hopeful to meet a lot of people that work extremely hard to make sure that these things do last, whether it's the maple syrup maker that I mentioned, or somebody who's growing cranberries in kind of a traditional way in southern Massachusetts, or people who are working to even just bring sheep's head to the table in New Orleans and allow people to experience that. It was very important and eventually very moving for me. Yeah.
And just to go back to something I said at the beginning, it clearly right now in America there are, I'm not sure how many people, but growing numbers of people who are thinking about what they're eating and are interested in supporting local producers and wanting to know who's grown the food that they ate and where it came from and getting it as fresh as possible. Starting to think more about that. And I find myself wondering whether that's going to result in some maybe larger scale change in the way Americans think about food.
I think that's something that's been going on for some time now. I think that once you start looking at food as something that should be fresh, where the ingredient is the important thing, and also thinking about its connection to the landscape, you end up working towards a more diverse and ultimately healthier and more enjoyable landscape. So let's hope that continues.
Well, we're here at just about the point where we have to finish up. Any last thing, if I had to say, okay, what right now would you like to have?
Ooh. That first breakfast I made was...
Oh, yeah. I wanted to ask you about... that you start out with, and just one thing I wanted to ask real quick about... One of the items on this was a porterhouse steak, and you said that the steak that he would have had, Twain would have had, would have been grass-fed and would have been dry aged.
When you hang it in a cool, dry place for maybe 4 weeks instead of wrapping it in plastic to maintain the moisture.
So what's the difference between that and the kind of steak that you go down to the supermarket and get?
Well, the grass gives it a more intense, distinctive flavor, and so does the dry aging. When you dry age something... It loses water, which is one reason that it's more expensive, because when you buy wet-aged steak, you're weighing in the water, and dry-aged has gotten lighter from the evaporation. But it's a denser flavor. The one I had, I didn't find any less juicy than wet-aging. I mean, it was really a wonderful piece of meat. But there's just an intensity and density of flavor that I'm not used to tasting in steak, really. And so there would have been more variety in steak in Twain's age because... you know, the different pastures that they're eating on and the skills of the people who are aging it. It was definitely less uniform. But, man, when you hit it right, there's just nothing better than that.
All right. Our guest, Andrew Beers. Go out and get his book, Twain's Feast, Searching for America's Lost Foods in the Footsteps of Samuel Clemens. Publisher is the Penguin Press. Mr. Beers, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for WILL comes from the Champaign County Humane Society, promoting animal welfare since 1951. Pet adoptions are available from the Humane Society, a member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll donations at work, on the web at cs-il.org. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from noon to 4 in the Bouvon's Tasting Room. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com or at 337-7704.
And a minute before 12 o'clock, I'm Jeff Bossert, filling in for Celeste Quinn today on the Afternoon Magazine. Coming up later in the noon hour, we'll have an interview with John Dowling. He's kind of a historian on the history of the 3I League. It's Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa minor league baseball from quite a while ago. He was a bat boy for the Danville Dodgers in 1946. We'll talk about his experiences then, getting to know some of the players, and his time as a kind of a historian on the history of that league. coming up at 12:40 this afternoon, an interview with John Dowling. And right now, a look at market numbers at the midday. In Kansas City, hard red winter wheat for December at 7.48¾, up 11.5. For March, 7.69¼, up 18.5. Chicago, December wheat at 7.16½, up 19.25. March, 7.44½, up 16.25. December corn, 5.18.